Hey, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to get into nebulizer treatments today. But if you'd like to know more, you should check out the Intensive Care Academy, our other program at ICU101.com, where we have video lessons on many, many topics. We just wrapped up a lesson on inserting IO lines, as well as one on PA catheters, both placing and interpreting them. A lot of recent procedural stuff. We're expanding the neuro ICU module right now. Lots of fun stuff. ICU101.com, if that's your thing, there's a continuing education credit available, a couple of private podcast feeds. I think you'll dig it. Otherwise, on to the show. Hey everyone, I'm Brandon Odo.
And I'm Brian Bowling.
And this is Critical Care Scenarios, the podcast where we use clinical cases, narrative storytelling, and expert guests to unpack how critical care is practiced in the real world.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the podcast. Brian Bowling with you here, and as always, Brandon Odo joining me.
Yo-ho.
We thought we would talk today about something that comes up a lot, I feel like, in the ICU, and most of us have little to no real knowledge of what we're doing with it. And that's nebs. I don't know about you, but I just tend to order nebs for people. My go-to is duo nebs, occasionally some steroids if they have COPD. But other than that, you know, they're kind of a mystery. So we figured that we should get somebody on here who marginally knows more than we do about it. And so we reached out to our old friend Keith Lamb. Keith's been on the podcast before. He's an RT at Centara down in Norfolk, Virginia, and sort of our go-to for everything we need to know about respiratory therapy. So welcome back, Keith.
Thank you, sir. Glad to be back.
So, Keith, you know, like Brian said, we generally order a lot of nebulizer treatments, probably in all inpatients, and certainly in the ICU, and certainly for people who are here for some sort of, you know, bronchospastic obstructive lung disease, but also for just like everyone. It's like a background part of care in a lot of cases. And I think for a lot of us who are ordering them, our understanding of this technology or drug or whatever it is we're giving is sort of loose. It's like, well, you put medicine in like into liquid and then you like turn it into bubbles and then it gets into the lungs and then just get some of that in there. It's like chicken soup, probably good for everyone, and that's about it.
I should point out that you should not nebulize chicken soup.
I don't know. You know,
somebody
I don't
will
know.
Do it. Somebody will yeah. do it.
Yeah. They used to talk in the ambulance about nebulizing coffee to get rid of bad smells. For,
oh, yeah. Yeah, we've done that before.
Transporting like a homeless person with toxic sock syndrome. Anyway, but back in reality, I thought we could just kind of narrow the gap between, you know, the like a well-educated respiratory therapist who are usually the people administering these in most places in the U.S. And the people who are ordering them so that we're all sort of on the same page. So we're going to talk kind of in general terms here, but let's start on a basic level. You admit somebody who we want to give a medication into their lungs, and many, you know, most of the time in the outpatient world, you know, when you're living your life, people are taking these using inhalers, you know, meter dose inhalers or the powder ones. And then most of the time when we bring people to the hospital, we'll switch them to similar medications nebulized. Although sometimes we can still give them inhalers in the hospital. What's your perspective on this? I mean, if we can give people inhalers, should we be doing that for inpatients? Are nebs better? Or is it just simple enough to switch everyone to a nebulized form if you can?
I think it depends on why the person's in the hospital, right? If they are admitted for a respiratory-related issue and they typically use inhalers at home, they probably are dyspneic. They're probably inspiratory flow rate that they can spontaneously generate is probably not appropriate for an inhaler. So, yeah, I think that people that are acutely dyspneic and respiratory failure, the deposition of an inhaler is not appropriate.
Yeah, the way I always think of it is, you know, to use an inhaler requires the patient kind of to do a lot of the right things, right. You know, inhale at certain times, certain speeds, and also just to sort of generally cooperate, like put your lips on this thing and take a breath at the right time. And so a person who is has maybe altered mental status may not be able to do that. And also a person who is already short of breath now you're asking them to, you know, breathe in a certain way, hold your breath, a lot of things that they might not be able to do, right?
Right, right, exactly.
Right. So the person who's here for some totally other reason, but they're with it, they're breathing normally, and this is just sort of maintenance care, why not do it? I mean, is it sort of cheaper and easier if you had the choice of both from your perspective, from the cost perspective, that kind of thing?
Yeah, it is cheaper to dispense an inhaler that they're going to take home with them. But it's also more resource intelligent, right? So because now they can take it themselves, the occasional supervision, just kind of check in and make sure they're okay and they know how to perform.
That covers kind of routine, normally breathing people. I mean, what about somebody who is on the ventilator, they're intubated or trached, I guess, or they're breathing non-invasive, CPAP or BiPAP or something? I mean, can you only use nebulizers then? Is it possible to use inhalers?
Yeah, so many years ago, we sort of did that. We had a, where I trained, we had an order set that said CombiVent inhaler, everybody who's intubated, 12 puffs, Q4.
12 puffs.
12 puffs, Q4. Well, the good thing was that they weren't getting any of it, really. So it wasn't hurting anybody. But they did. It's kind of a long story. I'll shorten it up a little bit. But we were, the RT department was kind of suspect of this abrupt change in practice, and so we sort of studied it and we looked at the cost, and it was, you know, for the MICU that had the average of 10 or to 14 ventilator patients at a time, 12 puffs Q4. Was costing about $200,000 a year just for the drug itself, not even accounting for the time that the RT was going to spend in the room every 4 hours doing this. No inhalers on ventilators. No inhalers on non-invasive. No inhalers on high flow.
Let's talk scheduling. Most of the, you know, inhaled nebulized treatments that we're using are typically albuterol and ipratropium, sometimes just albuterol, many times both. As Brian said, it's sort of easy to just give everyone both things. But so for kind of the typical person who we think should be receiving some sort of bronchodilator treatment, maybe they have COPD, asthma, maybe it's in some degree of exacerbation, maybe it's just more like background therapy, but we are sort of serious about it. It's not for no reason. So we want them to be on it. How often should these things be given? I mean, there's Q6, there's Q4, there's maybe Q less than that. And some people would split it up depending on which drug. What do you think?
Standard frequency is Q6 hours. There's not a good reason for that necessarily, other than they don't need it more often. If somebody has an acute reactive airway disease exacerbation, then I think it's reasonable to give it Q4, Q2 initially maybe.
Yeah, one of the things I was originally taught was Q6 is about as frequent as you should give ipratropium, and more frequent is somehow not, I don't know, not effective or maybe not safe. Whereas albuterol, you can maybe give more. If you're going to start getting aggressive, then you maybe give the albuterol more and more frequently, but maybe not so much for the ipratropium. I've never really seen that demonstrated anywhere. But I guess I, on some level, I buy that. You know, it's not like I wouldn't give ipratropium like every hour or something, whereas sometimes we'll be really aggressive with albuterol.
I remember, I've been doing this long enough that I remember when we used to carry around a little eyedropper bottle full of albuterol and just give it to anybody. You know, there was no Pyxis, there was no Omnicell. You didn't have to scan patients or drugs, or you just gave it to people that you think needed it.
I mean, many times for someone who is, we're trying to kind of maintain a regimen, I'll do, yeah, maybe do a NEBS, which is just a, you know, the combined form, ipratropium and albuterol. I mean, you could use them separately. It doesn't matter. Q6-ish. Maybe I'll schedule albuterol more often to kind of fill in Q, Q3, Q2, Q4, like some like kind of stagger them. And then often maybe add a PRN if someone needs even more in between. I wouldn't probably give a lot of more ipratropium between, like I said, but the albuterol maybe more often. And then this comes up also when you have people at home who are on a long-acting beta agonist, which is, you know, part of the backbone therapy for a lot of people with COPD and asthma and stuff. And you may be able to give that inpatient if you have the right inhalers. Most places don't have a whole lot of them. But again, if they're on the vent or something, maybe not. So oftentimes we'll convert that to just scheduled albuterol, you know, relatively frequently. The idea being it's the same sort of thing. You're just trying to give them some baseline amount of bronchodilation, beta agonism, but you can't give them the long-acting form, so we're giving them a short-acting form more frequently.
Yeah.
Continuous NEB treatments are kind of another matter, and this is something we'll do for usually when you really want to be aggressive. This is somebody who is actually here for respiratory failure from something like a COPD or asthma exacerbation, and you're really just trying to hit it hard and just sort of find how much bronchodilation we can cram into them. Mm-hmm. But continuous means sort of different things to different people. We're talking about albuterol here for the most part. Never heard of continuous ipratropium, but that's not like a dose, right? I mean, people will say, "Oh, continuous." It's like all the everything, but it may actually mean different things. So, I mean, to you, what does it mean to give a continuous albuterol nebulization? Like, how much are you giving? You know, over how long?
Continuous treatment typically means about 15 to 20 milligrams in an hour.
Continuous might be, let's say, 15 milligrams an hour. What is a single normal dose of albuterol?
One single normal dose is 2.5 milligrams.
Okay, so we're saying like 6-8 times or something the normal dose, but it's a volume of liquid that's being nebulized, right? Mm-hmm. So you dump it into this whatever you're delivering it with, and it just goes until it's gone, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the amount of time that it takes will depend on how much you put in, but it will probably take longer to give the more volume you put in, right? Or is it not so sensitive to that?
Yes. No, you're correct. It will.
Okay. So you're giving a larger total dose, but I mean, maybe a single normal dose would finish nebulizing in, I don't know what, 15 minutes or something like that?
Probably 10 minutes. Even less if you're using a vibrating mesh nebulizer. Yeah.
Okay. So that if you're giving, you know, whatever, 5 times that dose, it's not like you're giving it also in 10 minutes. It'll take longer, but they'll end up getting more.
Yeah. So the advantage, I think that the advantage of doing a continuous nebulizer treatment versus just dumping in one unit dose and letting it go through and then coming back and is twofold. One is that somebody doesn't have to stand there and open up another unit dose and dump it into the nebulizer. But probably more importantly is it is continuous and there's no lapse in between the drug delivery.
In your mind, if you're thinking of continuous as like it doesn't stop, it won't stop until it's done, but then it will stop. So if you want to really give continuous, you know, albuterol, once the last dose is done, you then need to give another continuous dose.
Yeah. So I guess continuous is a misnomer in effect. If you really want to give a continuous nebulizer treatment because the patient is so sick that you just need to give it and just keep giving it and not stopping until you get the desired effect, you really need to use a syringe pump and an aerogen. And then you can give it for hours. We use some continuous nebulizer therapy of like Flolan or Valitri for RV for significant RV failure. We'll put that in a syringe, use a syringe pump, use an aerogen, and just give it legit continuously for days.
You know, there are places where if you order a continuous neb, and there may not even be a separate order for this, but if there is, it might be that it's ordered in some way that would make it sort of repeating or recurrent. But generally what I've seen is there is a volume. So it, there's just this kind of confusing tension between like dose and volume and time. So I think the most practical thing for people is to think if you like you're in your mind, you're just continuously hitting this person with albuterol and you, that's what your goal is. And you want to keep going until it stops. You should probably order whatever and then tell the therapist when it's done, either do it again or let me know and I'll order it again, something like that. Because if you assume it's going to keep going, it's not. It's going to go until it's done. It's like, I'm trying to think of an analogy. It'd be like if you gave fluids, and if you think that you're giving it like a continuous IV fluid that'll run until it's done, it's not like that. It'll be like if you ordered a drip and then you put a stop time on it. That's what's going to happen. It's going to stop at some point. So just you need to like coordinate to be like, my goal is for this to keep going. Let me know when it's done and maybe we'll, you know, do it again, something like that.
Yeah. So really, so the standard approach typically is to order 15 milligrams over an hour.
And I have seen some people use kind of an alternative to continuous to do something like hourly, like Q1 hour albuterol treatments. But, you know, if think about what we're saying, that's probably a substantially lower dose.
Much lower.
Unless the, what you're giving hourly is a bunch. If you're giving your normal, quote, single dose Q hourly, it's much more than you would give for like routine care, but it's not as much as you could be giving with some of the, one of the other approaches to this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we should probably get to the devices then. What are the different, you know, technologies or, you know, methods of nebulizing that people will see out there? And this is probably something most folks placing these orders don't even think about, but there are different technologies and it sounds like it pertains to some of the practicalities here.
Standard particulate size is 1 to 5 microns maybe is what you really want if it's a drug that you want to get to the lower respiratory tract. It sort of depends on what medicine you're giving. You know, if you're given a bronchodilator, you want it to get lower. If you're given racemic epi, for instance, you want it to stay up top. We typically use Aerogens for the vibrating mesh nebulizers for patients that are on that are intubated, or if they are on non-invasive ventilation, or if they're on high flow nasal cannula, then we use that technology. If somebody is just taking a single nebulizer treatment one time every 6 hours and they're not intubated, then we'll use a small volume nebulizer. All of them sort of have similar performance characteristics in terms of what the particulate size is, that or what the size of the medicine that they nebulize. The vibrating mesh probably makes smaller, closer to 1 micron. And then the small volume nebulizer, probably 5 or even a little larger than that.
I mean, what I feel like I've most commonly seen, and I mean this for a long time, is, you know, you put a little bit of liquid into a little chamber and you fire some gas flow into it and then it makes smoke. I mean, that's like a small volume nebulizer.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the one. That's the one that's disposable and you find in the drawer in the right. Patient's room. And
so the Aerogen, a vibrating mesh, is a whole different device.
It is. It's driven. It has an electronic driver that plugs into the wall, the electric outlet. It does exactly what it sounds. It's got a mesh that's made out of palladium, and it vibrates so soft, so quickly that it nebulizes the liquid.
I don't even know if I've seen. I mean, maybe we use them on the ventilator, perhaps. But so in your case, you would generally use that for patients who are vented or on non-invasive or something. But someone just getting kind of routine one-off, you know, they have a mask or holding a T-piece or something, it might just be a small volume thing.
There are places who have, not ours, but some places that have transitioned to using the vibrating mesh nebulizer for everybody, because you can interface it with just an aerosol mask that you would nebulize the treatment with. It's more efficient, right? You get better deposition with the vibrating mesh. It's smaller particulate. You're more likely to get the physiologic response that you want to get, and it's faster. It takes less time to nebulize the medicine. You know, every day, just Q4 hour maintenance nebulizer therapy. We typically will just use the disposable, less expensive.
So when you're using, and maybe it differs between these, there's some kind of chamber you'll put in the actual medication, let's say albuterol, And then generally also some diluent, you'll add some fluid, or is it sometimes just the straight drug?
Yeah, it's typically the, so if you're using just a single unit dose of Duaneb, for instance, that's got enough volume to just run it by itself. If you take out a racemic epi single dose, it's typically just like a half a milliliter of volume. So that's not enough volume to allow the treatment to last long enough to be effective. You would have to add some saline to it.
Are you also setting for both these devices some kind of speed or rate or power or something that determines how quickly you'll nebulize?
Yeah, so it's based on the nebulizer performance and the manufacturer recommendation, but usually it's somewhere between 8 and 10 liters of gas from the wall.
So that's for the small volume. The Aerogen also is based on a flow rate?
No, it's not. It's not attached to any kind of gas source. It's just plugged into the wall. It's electronic.
Okay. So do you set some kind of power or something on that, or it's just one thing for everything? It's just on or off.
It's just on or off. Yeah.
But even for the small volume ones, it's a certain flow rate, but it's not like you would sometimes do more or sometimes less. There's sort of a right flow to get the effect. Yeah.
Yeah. Whatever works for that specific device.
So the duration or how quickly you nebulize ends up being based on the dose you put in
and
the volume. I mean, you can dilute it and then it would take longer and eventually get the same, or, and then there's sort of a minimum because a small enough volume, it just sort of doesn't work. It's like a drop that just sticks to the side or something.
Right. It doesn't have, yeah, exactly.
I think this is probably helping to get people understand how these things kind of go together, you know, the volumes and the doses and stuff. And some of it is fixed and some of it is controllable. And I guess the variable that we're not considering is just how much drug is actually landing on the tissue you want and being absorbed, because it's a pretty indirect method, right? Some of these droplets are getting stuck on the tubes or in your mouth or something, or, you know, tissues that are not helpful. And only some are landing at the desired site, and never mind whatever local anatomy is going on, and they get stuck in mucus or something like that. So we're kind of eyeballing the effect, but just trying to get as much of it to the right ballpark as we can.
You know, use an aerosol mask, they probably get more medicine that lands on their face than actually gets into the airways. So typically people will get better deposition if they use the mouthpiece.
And I have to think that it depends how they're breathing. I don't know if their respiratory rate or how their flow rate they're sucking in makes a difference, but certainly I'm sure how deeply they're breathing. I mean, I often think that if they're really in respiratory distress, nebulizing through their BiPAP or a vent or something is probably getting more drug in there than if they're just taking tiny little panting breaths on their own, for instance. So we talked about kind of, quote, routine NEB treatments. You've said, and I think this is generally consensus, that if someone is intubated, they don't just need NEBs just because. And some people do think that, like the device itself may promote bronchospasm or something like that. I mean, I don't think it's necessarily wrong to have a PRN for people just if you think something might come up. But they certainly don't need to be on scheduled albuterol or anything like that. Somebody who needs baseline therapy because they have COPD or something, I mean, that's a different story. That's sort of a maintenance kind of thing. But, you know, it comes up in other cases too. For instance, let's say you're giving somebody inhaled N-acetylcysteine, Mucomist. We'll often hear that they do need to have albuterol or something ordered. I've heard two reasons. One is just that the Mucomist needs some kind of like something to put it in, like a carrier. And what you'll hear more often is that it tends to promote bronchospasm, so you should give it with a bronchodilator. Do you think that's true?
Probably has enough volume that it doesn't really need a carrier. But I do think, and I have seen patients that did not have bronchospasm, but did after they received Mucomist alone. So I always give it with albuterol. There's not a ton of data that suggests one way or the other.
I mean, I'm not sure there's a ton of data for giving Mucomist in general, but
there's actually zero data for giving Mucomist. It's really and hypertonic saline and Mucomist, Pulmozyme, all those drugs that sort of break up, you know, mucus and help expectorate mucus. there's very little data, and particularly in the average patient that's not a cystic fibrosis patient.
I mean, this gets to the whole general topic of pulmonary toilet. And when you have the patient who's got bad pneumonia or something, and you really are just trying to help them clean that stuff out, and maybe they're intubated, or maybe you're trying to avoid it, something like that, and you're like, we just need to help this patient get this stuff out. We can't make them, you know, cough, but we can support them. And maybe we'll do like chest PT, and maybe we'll give them Mucomist or something. But many people will also give bronchodilators. I mean, I guess maybe set aside the question of should you give it with Mucomist, but just as a treatment itself for pulmonary toileting. And I'm never quite sure what to make of that, because inherently bronchodilation, I wouldn't think, helps you clear pus and mucus out of your lungs. Mm-hmm. But maybe there's some sort of synergistic effect, or maybe it's just this like chicken soup thinking that it, quote, can't hurt. I mean, what do you think? Should somebody who just needs like to help pulmonary toilet be on albuterol or bupropion or some combination?
I'm a big believer in just customizing your treatment. I'll give them albuterol and Atrovent. Bronchodilators, I don't know how effective they are, particularly if you don't have abnormal airway caliber with reactive airway disease, because I don't think that you open the airways anymore with a bronchodilator.
I guess my take is usually that like this is not treating what they have. However, it's in that realm of like, do I know that they don't have any of that? I mean, do I know in my heart of hearts that there is no degree of bronchoconstriction that I could reverse, and that may help them clear some stuff out, or at least feel a little better and have less respiratory effort? I mean, I have asthma myself, and there are certainly have been times when I had whatever, a cold or something. I didn't think I was having like an asthma attack, but taking a little bit of albuterol seemed to help me breathe a little more easily. And so, I mean, if you could do that for someone, then maybe why not? It's like a lot of things where giving a treatment that's sort of adjacent to the important thing is probably not the key. And if someone really thinks they're like, this is treating their problem, I would think that they are misguided on that. But it may be also a little bit of humility in that I don't know that there couldn't be some of that. It's like when we have cirrhotics who are bleeding and they have an elevated INR, because that just happens in cirrhosis. And I don't think it's because they are deficient in vitamin K, like a patient on Coumadin, warfarin. And someone will always say, let's give them some vitamin K. And my mindset is always like, if you're giving that because you think that is treating their cirrhosis-related, you know, coagulation abnormality, you don't understand the physiology. But do I know this patient cannot also be deficient in vitamin K because maybe they're a little malnourished or something? No, I don't know that. It's possible. And the drug is harmless, so sure. And I think we're kind of in that realm. I mean, if albuterol was $10,000 or something, I'd say like, no. But this patient who is like dying of respiratory failure, yeah, sure. If it's that important to me to get every last percent, then I think it's reasonable to add some of this in.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it would be crazy to think that if you were my patient and I gave you an albuterol treatment and you said, I feel better after that albuterol treatment, then regardless of if it makes physiologic sense to me, I would still give it to you, right? I would mm-hmm. not give it to you anymore. But I do think giving a drug can be a distractor, right? And it can certainly make you feel comfortable that you're doing something when you might not be. You might not be doing what really the patient really needs.
Yeah, I agree with that. And it whether diverting resources or just your attention or, I mean, in acute cases, even time. I mean, maybe an example would be the patient with congestive heart failure. And maybe they're wheezing and, you know, maybe this is like it's from edema. It's like a cardiac wheeze. But someone's like, oh, maybe we should get. So is it wrong to give that patient inhaled albuterol or something? You know, we used to think maybe it was somehow could worsen the edema. I don't know if that's true, but I think it is wrong if it distracts you from doing an actual treatment. No, don't get the CPAP. Mm-hmm. Give them a NEB. That's wrong.
I guess that's really what I'm talking about, right? And if I thought that giving somebody, every patient in a hospital, do a NEB, Q4 hours, I would probably try to figure out some way of piping it into the AC.
Yeah.
Because I wouldn't have time to go give several hundred people them treatments. But we would work it out, right? If we thought that was the right thing to do, we shouldn't be lackadaisical with our resource management and our time, because that's one, you know, if I'm giving a nebulizer treatment to somebody that's not going to benefit from them, then that's 15 minutes of my time that I could be, you know, doing something that's useful for somebody else.
Yeah, the next time we're like, hey, where's respiratory? I got to make this vent change, or we got to like intubate this patient, and they're down the hall giving a neb treatment order 10 hours ago.
Yeah, yeah.
Providers and prescribers, I think we need to sort of internalize that, that maybe the answer is not ordering nebs. Maybe the answer is having a conversation with your RT and saying, listen, you are the expert at this sort of thing. What do you recommend? What would be good here? You know, and I think, I mean, I knew a little bit about giving nebs when I was a nurse. I worked in an ER one time where the nurses actually gave most of the nebs themselves. But you know, hearing you talk about it, you realize like how much more involved it is than just, you know, squirt, you know, and I think that's something that I find myself guilty of sometimes too, is just saying like, well, you know, they feel like they can't breathe, give them a breathing treatment, and not really going, well, but you're not wheezy. You don't need a bronchodilator, right? They just feel short of breath. So try nebs.
When I think part of that is if we're giving a treatment for some very concrete, like evidence-based reason, and that's sort of maybe a different matter. But a lot of what we do is for stuff that has a somewhat subjective endpoint. We want people to feel better, or we want to, you know, help them cough up mucus or something like that. That from our slightly more distant perspective, we probably don't have a lot of good feedback on that, whether it even works. You know, we give orders, we go off. Whereas the respiratory therapists and the nurses are the ones who are there, and they can say, oh, generally when we do that, they do feel better, or we get some mucus or something like that. So their ability to have that kind of feedback is probably a lot stronger than ours. And so that's a very useful perspective versus us. It was just like a screen full of orders, and we're like, oh, this all seems to be in the right sort of ballpark of things. Let's just click them all.
Also, though, it was interesting when you were talking about the evidence or lack thereof for mucomist and even hypertonic saline, because I order hypertonic saline pretty regularly on people. You know, I have a lot of people who have been in the neuro ICU and the surgical ICU, both who are just very weak and can't mobilize their secretions. They have thick secretions. And we do that to sort of induce coughing and sort of thin things up. But it's interesting because when I was a fairly new provider, I think I ordered Mucomist. That was my kind of go-to because someone had told me Mucomist is good. And then someone else told me, I think one of the RTs actually told me, you know, no, Mucomist, there's really no good evidence for just hypertonic saline's better. And so at our place, hypertonic comes in 3% and 7%. And I remember, you know, which one do I pick? I don't know. 3%. That sounds fine. And one day one of the Palm fellows rotated through our ICU with us, and he very passionately argued that 7% was the way to go. And so now I just sort of order 7%, and I don't really know why. Right? Like, just, why do I order 7% instead of 3%? Yeah, it's because the most recent case that someone made for it, and I'm like, okay. If someone told me today, you know, passionately that 7% was, you know, evil and you should always do this, I'd probably go, all right, I'll do that then, I guess.
Yeah, I think there's always a tension between the two sides, right? Like us placing the orders, it really should listen to the people who are on the ground doing these things because they have this perspective that's powerful. On the flip side, I mean, we shouldn't also just listen to someone say like, I've never done it this way, or this is weird, or this is a lot of work or something, and then just do whatever they say, because there may be a compelling medical reason to do something. But that's just the reason to have those conversations, because it's same thing as when we order a weird drug and the nurse says, like, what is this? And we could figure out, is this an error? Is this the wrong thing? Or is this an important thing to do? And just all kind of, you know, work it out. But
yeah, if anybody who says we've always done it this way or we've never done it this way should be put in timeout.
No, I mean, I think this is like many things. Like it was really helpful for all of us in the chain of things to understand down to the somewhat granular level. Otherwise, you know, all the way upstream, we end up, you know, planning things or ordering things that don't really make sense if we understood what was going on. But we don't, because there's this disconnect. So kind of strengthening that whole chain of causality ends up providing better care and certainly kind of more practical, more efficient care, which in the grand scheme of things ends up meaning the same thing because, you know, inefficiencies or irrationalities in what we do ends up filtering down to actual people and actual bottom lines and stuff like that. So, all right, guys, why don't we wrap it up there? Keith, thanks for joining us, and we will talk to you next time.